Hello, and welcome to the Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month. This monthly cassette CD series represents yet another step in accomplishing Granting Associates' vision of helping the service contractor come to a place of maturity and profitability. Each month, a different national speaker from throughout the service and trades industry shares dozens of cost-reducing, profit-increasing ideas to help you become a more profitable company. There's a book that has recently been listed as the number one New York Times bestseller called The Purpose-Driven Life by Rick Warren. I'm sure many of you have read it. I want to share a portion of the book. Quote, "Knowing your purpose simplifies your life. It defines what you do and what you don't do. Your purpose becomes the standard you use to evaluate which activities are essential and which aren't. You simply ask, does this activity help me fulfill one of God's purposes for my life? Without a clear purpose, you have no foundation on which you base decisions, allocate your time, and use your resources. You will tend to make choices based on circumstances, pressures, and your mood at that moment. People who don't know their purpose try to do too much, and that causes stress, fatigue, and conflict. But on the other hand, purpose-driven living leads to a simpler lifestyle and a saner schedule. Without a clear purpose, you will keep changing directions, jobs, relationships, churches, or other externals, hoping each change will settle the confusion or fill the emptiness in your heart." This is a great quote and leads us into this month's presentation. This month's tape or CD is actually a teaching presented by Pastor Steve Deniff, who is senior pastor of College Wesleyan Church in Marion, Indiana, on the campus of Indiana Wesleyan College. The essence of the message is much like the quote we just read. It asks the question, why are we doing what we are doing? Pastor Steve's message was actually entitled, My Calling to Fulfill. But the tape title we have chosen is a direct quote from a portion of the tape. It's always helpful to take a bit of time from our busy schedules to simply reflect on why we are doing what we are doing. I think you'll find this month's presentation thought-provoking as well as very entertaining. We will look forward to your feedback. Now, let's listen to this month's tape entitled, If You Don't Understand the Game, the Only Thing That's Important is the Hot Dog.
The ancients believed in fate. There was an ancient god by the name of Nyx, whose children guarded the river between life and death. And when you came to the river to cross it, you met three people, now known as three fates. You met the first one, Clotho, who would take the fabric of human life, the story that is being played, and lay it out there with a distaff and a spindle in her hand. And then next to her was Lachesis, was her name, who would reach in and pull a thread out from the story, and that's you, that's your life. And the third one, Atropos, would cut it. And the analogy, of course, is that it is up to the gods to determine what you will be, how long you will live, whether or not you matter, whether you actually do anything or you're just fodder for the gods in heaven. There's a saying that when a man has a destiny, he is invincible until that destiny is fulfilled in his life. I'm wondering if we haven't, in our thinking, shifted from a destiny to a fate. Fate. The word fate, it's a Latin term. Fare means to speak. And what it means was, you can say anything you want to say. You can say you're going to be somewhere, say you're going to become something, say you're going to get over that sickness. You can say you're going to make $1 million or you're going to be a school teacher. You're going to raise children. Say anything you want. But you never know whether it's true until the gods in heaven speak it. And since the gods aren't talking, the only way you know is you have to wait to the end of life, where you turn around and you look at your circumstances and you measure what happened to you and you say, ah, the gods have spoken. That's what was supposed to happen. So you're not in control. You're never in control. On your best day, you're just dodging things. Have you played dodgeball? Dodgeball is where they put the balls in the middle of the floor and everybody runs to the middle, picks up a ball. Some of you are smiling saying, yeah, I killed some innocent people playing that game. You meet in the middle and you pick up the ball and you quick try to throw it and hit somebody in the legs or in the arm or, if you really want to, the head. And the main thing is they can't catch the ball that you just threw at them, because if they catch the ball in the air, then you're out. But if they drop the ball, then they're out. And the object of the game is to knock the other team out. I mean, out cold, if you can. When I was a kid, we'd take a Monday night gymnasium at Wall Street School, and we put the balls in the middle of the floor, and how it was that all the adults ended up on one side, and all the kids, I mean children, 10, 12 years old, on the other side. I think what it was a bunch of angry white males who got out one night in a week, and they were going to vent all of their anger on the kids. Of course, they did it while smiling. And so you'd run to the middle, and they'd pick them up, and they'd just be giggling while the little kid wandering around looking for a ball. And they would see his spindly little legs. I know this, you see. And as he was moving across, they would just time him and just go and get him in the legs, bam, knock his legs right out from under him, put him right on his side. And you hear these guys go, and all of his men go, oh, you're the man. Just beat a 10-year-old. You'd stand all the way to the back of the wall, and you'd watch these big adults, some big, just take the ball and just wind up. I mean, they're like in the pocket, cucking and throwing as hard as they could, and you could hear the wind as it missed your head, if it missed your head. You never hear the one that gets you. He'd move, it would bam, hit the wall behind you and just echo. I now imagine that all of these guys are in their 80s and 90s, and they're in nursing homes. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Don't you want to get a whole shopping cart full of old leather volleyballs? Go through that nursing home. Excuse me. Are you Lester Skaggs? Yes. Wait right here, buddy. I'll be right back with a pumpkin for you. Every once in a while, one of them would be gracious and they would change sides. They'd come over onto our side of the gym. So now, when the minute they did that, we looked at each other and thought, there's hope. We are no longer slaughtered. And so we ran to the back of the wall and just waited for the guy to throw the cannon and get out of the way, feel sorry for the guy it hit, try to knock the ball down, and then we'd take the ball and roll it up. Not even come close to the line, because they'd kill us. Roll it up to the front and let the adult that was up there just take that thing and go on a hunting spree. Now, it was a little more even. We had one of you over here with us. Now, hold that image in your mind, because that's a pretty good description of the way the ancients viewed the gods. You see, the gods were in heaven, and you are on earth. And the gods would just reach back and start hurling one national tragedy after another. One sickness, one disease. I mean, all you could do in life was just to hope you didn't get hit. You never win. You survive. And you just get out of the way. You feel sorry for the family that just got it. But you wish you could level the score. And suddenly, imagine if somebody came to you and said, the biggest god over there has just changed sides. He's coming on your side now. He's got the strongest arm and the most deadly aim. But he's also got a really big heart for people like you. I am the God who made you. 2 weeks ago. I am the God who sees you. I love you. Last week, I am the God who is changing sides. Anything you could do, I could do better. But, says the Lord, we're going to do it together. I'm actually going to bring you onto my side, and we will do things together. Oh, man. You've got to know what a huge difference that was to what the people were used to hearing. So I began to study, what does it mean for God to come to us and call us? Stop. I no longer have to wait till I get to the end of life and turn around and say, I wonder what I was supposed to be. Jeez, I hope that was the right thing to do. I wonder if we did. I don't have to do that anymore. Now God has spoken, and He is putting a call in my life. And that means I can know early on what I'm supposed to do. And it means I can feel as though all of the dodgeballs that I'm dodging are actually part of a grand design that God has built into my life. I don't have to wait for fate. I believe in destiny because I believe in design. I don't have to believe in luck. I believe in providence. I don't have to dream. I have to hear a voice. All the difference in the world when God calls. Here's what I discovered, that God will call everyone in this room, everyone, bar none, two times. First time, He wakes you up. Second time, He gets you going. When I was a kid, we got two calls in the morning. One was to wake up, and the other was to get going. The wake up was simply a walk by the room, and you hear the sound on the door. And if you're lucky, you heard both. Let's go. Time to get up in there. That was a subtle, tactful, kind way of saying, get out of bed. So you roll out of bed, and you wait about 30 to 35 minutes. And then you hear another voice. Come on, we're leaving. That meant you had to go out the door. So that meant you put your shoes in your hand, your socks in your teeth, Pop-Tarts in your arm, everything. Your food's in your pockets. And you're running out the door to get in the car, because if you miss the car, you're going to miss school. And just that way, God will call every single person. Every single person. Even you. Two times. One, He will call you to wake you up. That's a call of discipleship. That's a call of conversion. In the call of conversion, God simply says, you, come and be my disciple. All He's asking you to do now, and it's not small, is to build your whole life around a single center and axis, and to say, this is the reason that I'm alive. I am here to glorify that person. Some people never get this, and so the other call doesn't help them much. But the first call simply says, you are to be a Christian. The second call is a call not to conversion, but a call into a cause. It's into a cause that is greater than you are. And so the same Jesus who says to you, come and follow me, that's one, will turn and say, and I will make you fishers of men. That's two. He will come and take disciples that they might be with them. That's one. And that He might send them out to heal and to teach and to preach. That's two. God always calls us into His kingdom and then attaches us to a cause that is bigger than our lives. That's really good, because there's something inside of you right now, no matter who you are, that really wants to do something that's bigger than life. Even if it's just stay home and raise children after His way. That's enormous. And there's something inside of us that wants to do something that is longer than our funeral. And the good news is that God has wired us to do that, and that He will one day call us into that kind of a thing. And the even better news is that some people get a direct call from God where he simply says, Moses, and you look over and the pulpit is on fire and it is not being consumed. And you go, wow, that's a call. You better do something, even if it's called the fire company. That's an attention getter when something like that. Or you're laying on your bed and you hear a voice in the night that says, Samuel, Samuel. He's like, who could miss that, Samuel? He missed it two times. It took the third time for him to get it, but he finally got it. It was a call from the outside. You know, he woke up and said, hey, I mean, who's calling me here? But just as often, God comes to people on the inside. You don't hear a thing. Why that's really good news is because most of you in the room will never hear an audible voice from God. I really wish you could. I mean, I wish you could get a phone call, or even if somebody would come to you and say, you know what? God has spoken to me. This is what you're supposed to do with your life. And let's be honest, even if somebody did that, you'd walk home and think, he's one of those. You know, you just don't know. And so you live with a certain amount of uncertainty your whole life. Here's what I did. I went into the Old Testament, and I found two characters who fit into a place in Israel's history that was huge, so that when they finished their task, all of Israel remembered them as great leaders for hundreds of years after they were dead. You can read it in extra biblical sources. These are two people, neither one heard a voice from God, neither one. And yet, if you were to ask both of them, are you doing the thing in your life that you think God has wired or destined you to do? Both of them would look at you and say, absolutely, not a shred of doubt in my mind. And they would go to their grave saying that. So I started thinking, how did they do it? What did they find? What I found was different than what I was thinking. Here's the story. Israel had about 20 kings. 8 of them were good. If this were baseball, that'd get you into the playoffs. This is politics. That'll get you into prison. And so what happened was, Babylon, this huge nation, you know them as Iraq, they came over from the east and moved down and gobbled up Israel. They went into Jerusalem. I mean, that's like Washington, D.C., only better. And they knocked down the walls, went into the Holy of Holies, destroyed everything of the temple. Now you got no place to worship. Most of your priests are dead. And remember, yours is a religion that is highly tactile. It's not just get into a room, sing Kumbaya, and feel the presence of God. No, no. No, this is Judaism here. We have symbols. We have laws. We have sacred ground. We have people who wear funny things on their top. That's holy vestments. I mean, this is highly tangible stuff. And all of that stuff is being taken away from you. Israel is in complete disarray. The year is 586 B.C. Within 50 years, a fellow would arise from a tiny little country and would take power over a whole new empire known as Persia. This little king who became a great leader, his name is Cyrus the Great. He writes on a piece of paper or something, he writes that Israel should be free to go back to its homeland in order to repatriate the area. And that's what they do. A lot of Jews go back into Jerusalem and they start rebuilding the temple. I mean, that's the holy place. We can't have church until we have a temple. Historians tell us that the reason Cyrus did this was because he was trying to protect himself politically. We know better. We know it's because God is writing a story. And Cyrus doesn't know it. But God, like a master player of chess, is moving people into the position he wants them to be. In fact, Isaiah 44, verse 28, and 45, verse 1. You don't have to turn, just listen. Both of those passages predict that a leader named Cyrus would arise and that God would move Cyrus's heart to turn his people back to the homeland. And did I say it was more than 100 years before the edict? No. God is writing a story. And when God writes stories, He takes people wittingly and unwittingly, and He moves them into place. Less than 5 years after Cyrus does this, he's headed off to battle, suddenly dies. His son Cambyses takes over and starts mopping up the nations one after the other. He goes down into Egypt, which was then like the USSR, this big old, and takes a whole chunk of Egypt with him and starts wiping out sacred temples. Nobody knows why. He just didn't want people to have sacred temples. But when he gets to a region known as Elephantine near the Nile River, he stops and he comes upon a Jewish temple, and for some unknown reason, he leaves it alone. Nobody knows why, but those who read Scripture believe that even there, God is still writing His script. Well, the Jews go back to Israel, and they start rebuilding the temple. The enemies move in. Surrounding governors call the National Guard. They send the troops in. They get the whole project to shut down. They go to the king, Xerxes, and then Artaxerxes, and they petition and saying, "You've got to stop the project here." The king gets enraged. He writes another law that says, "Everything stop. No more building in Israel. It's done." And into that vacuum, Israel, with its hopes in the air, "We're going to get it back again, man. We're almost done." And suddenly the king turns. Into that vacuum, God calls two men. One of them is Ezra. He's a priest. He's a preacher. He says in Ezra chapter 9, he loved to study the Word, memorizing it, learning it, teaching it. And the other one is Nehemiah, who's a wine taster. He's a cupbearer. He works in a bar, you'd say. Not quite that bad, but close. I mean, in other words, he wasn't a member of a Wesleyan church. He was serving drinks to the king. And sometimes when you serve the king's drinks, we know this, you had to taste it first to protect the king. Anything wrong with the drink, it happens to you first. And you see this guy going over and saying, "Hang on, just a second. Okay, hang on. Oh, not sure. Oh, wait, almost. Yeah, you don't know what's going on, but this is a guy that has a completely different occupation." And so when Ezra looks over and he sees the people going back home, he says to him, "You know what? I want to go lead Bible studies." And when Nehemiah hears about this, he says, "You know what I want to do? I want to go build a wall. I want to be a contractor." Those are two different jobs. Ezra, he has lineage as long as your arm. It's in Ezra 7, first five verses. I mean, priest, Ezra. And then there's Nehemiah, who says in Nehemiah 1, verse 1, you see it? "My father was Hakaliah, and, well, after that I can't remember." That's it. So you have these two guys with the seemingly opposite backgrounds, and yet somehow God is calling them into, watch this, His story. Here's what I discovered. God is telling a story this morning. He's still writing it. We're watching nations move powers. We're watching empires fall. We're watching the center of Christianity move from America to third world countries. We're watching the world shrink. We're watching new threats we never dreamed of years before. We're seeing the fall of denominations and the rise of large churches. We're seeing changes in education and in medicine and in law and politics. And there's a tendency to think that history is nothing more than a list of decisions that individuals have made. But I'm telling you this morning, God is still writing a script. Here's the other half. Your part, your place in this world, flows out of His story. So that if you can find out what God is doing big, then you can take what you love to do and you can connect that to the story that He has been telling for thousands of years, and it'll click for you. And until you can do this, it's a job. But the minute you say, oh yeah, it becomes a vocation. Might be the same job, but there's a connection for the first time. Watch what Nehemiah does. In Nehemiah chapter 1, he says, it was in the month of Kislev, that's verse 1, I went and I asked people, have you been over to Israel to see what's going on? Verse 2, they said, yeah, we've been there. What did you find? Verse 3 says, we found the walls were torn down, the city was in disarray, the gates had been burned, the people are all over the place. Things are not going well. Look at verse 4 of chapter 1. When I heard these things, I sat down and I wept and I mourned and I prayed. Watch this. For 4 months, we know from comparing the first verse of chapter 1 with the first verse of chapter 2, it was 4 months before Nehemiah ever went to the king. So what he's saying is this: God has been writing a story. And I'm over here hundreds of miles away inside of this little citadel of Susa, this little 2.5 mile mound of kingdom that belongs to Persia. I'm doing my job. I'm just working away, and all of a sudden I ask an innocent question. How are things going over there? Someone says they're going awful. And when I heard that, my heart broke. And when my heart broke, I started to cry. And I began to pray. That's verse 4. Now look at verse 5. And when I prayed, this is what I said. Oh God, You are writing a covenant with Your people. You made a covenant with us. Verse 7. God, remember, we broke Your commandments. You told us what to do and we disobeyed You. Verse 8. But God, You said that if we broke Your rules, You'd break us. But if we returned to You, then You would return to us. Verse 10. Now God, please remember, these are the people that You've redeemed. Stop. How does Nehemiah get this? Nehemiah cannot know what he wants to do until first he knows what God has been doing in history. And the moment he hears what's happening and he connects it to the history that God has with His people. Oh God, You made a covenant. We broke it. But You promised. Please remember us. He's telling the history of His people. You know how hard it is to talk to people today in America who don't have a sense of history. Man, we don't care that the previous generation lived. 1 out of 5 under 30 don't even believe the Holocaust happened. When something didn't happen in our generation, we don't care. And yet, with no sense of history, we're still moving around trying to say, well, that doesn't matter. What's my place? And it's almost as if the Lord says, no, you don't matter. The story is what matters. And you will never matter until you tie into His story. And we are a generation who believes that God's purpose is to come and tell us what our place in life is. And yet if we would do that, I think God would look at us and say, you've got it backwards. Don't ask me what you should do. Ask me what I am already doing. And something in the plot will grab you. I was at a football game in the University of Michigan, by the way. where God's team plays. 106,000 fans watching the best team, not the other one, in the nation. And while we sat there, my son and I got free tickets, sat 73 rows up, and we sat behind this couple, this odd couple. I was 45 years old, and his son was with him. And they were shoving hot dogs down and drinking things and complaining. Oh, Dad, did you see how long the line was in the bathroom? Who cares? Look at the game. As soon as they could finish one, they ate another. And then it occurred to me just before halftime, why? The son turns to the father and says, Dad, by the way, how many innings in a football game? The father, instead of correcting the indigent, turns to his son and says, I don't think I know. My son turns to me with, like, he just saw a ghost look on his face. He's shaking his head and he says, I can't believe that. I said, some things defy the imagination. Then he said, Dad, what? Who in their right mind would pay $50 or $60? That's what it costs to sit all the way up here if they didn't understand the game. You see, when you don't understand the game, all that's important is the hot dog. I think the reason we are so trapped in the present moment is because we have lost the plot. We are like children in a Christmas pageant. We move up from the side. We stand in the middle in front of a microphone too tall. We say our lines and then we head for cover. And you know the main thing on our minds and the minds of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and great-great-great-grandparents out to the parking lot while they're running the video camera is this. Oh, I wonder how he's going to do today. He really had it down. Oh, I hope he gets this. And you know, sometimes we fail to see that the pageant itself is a plot. And we've reduced it to a series of individual pieces recited by children, filmed by parents. You see, when you miss this, all that's important is this. But when you get this, suddenly you connect. Watch what Nehemiah did. I got a sense of history. I knew God was up to something and this was a time. And he started with an idea. Verse 3. The walls have been torn down. And then he wrapped his idea in passion. Verse 4. When I heard these things, I wept. He brought a need and a passion into one place. Listen to me. Some of us will pursue in our lives and are pursuing now things that are of great need for our people, our culture. But the things that we are pursuing do not light a passion in our souls. And until our soul has caught a passion for the thing that we are doing, we either ought to do it differently or do something else. There are others among us who are pursuing things that they're passionate about. They want to go make money. They want to pursue a sports career. But until we are able to connect money and sports to a need in this world, believe it or not, it doesn't matter who wins. Until we can connect those two, We either ought to work the job differently or work a different job. Because the thing that we're called to do is to plug into His story. We're not called to pay bills or fill holes or pay off debts. God has called us for bigger things. And so some of us may be doing the most trite of jobs, but we are doing it with passion, and we believe we are changing a part of our world because we understand the story. And so I give you these questions. One, what is it? What is it that God is doing in our world now? This community, I mean. I don't mean just the world. I mean this community. Let's start with Marion. What is God doing in this community right now? And I know if you go in college, the thing is, oh, look, man, I'm here for 3 or 4 years, and then I'm out of here. This isn't my town. Yeah, that's right. But right now it is. Right now it is. And I know it's a lot more fun and exotic to get on a plane and fly way over there and do things in the far seas and come back and say, you know where I went? And they go, you went where? Yeah, I know you can do a lot better slideshow on something over there than you can here. But right now, this is the field in front of you. Right now, this is it. This may not be ever, but this is it for now. I'm having a hard time justifying opportunities that are going by because I'm in pursuit of something more grand in the back. What is God up to in our community? Two, what promises has God given us that He has not yet fulfilled in our life? I promised you I would bring you back to your homeland. You're not there yet. Nehemiah, this is your hour. Question three, what are the greatest needs that I look around my people and I see? Look in my dorms, I look in my offices, in my workplaces, and I am walking by things that 6 months ago when I was new here might have caught my attention. But because I've sort of slipped into it, I am less sensitive. So what are the needs that I see surrounding me? What are the things that God is asking your generation to do, this one right now, that the previous generation left undone? My forefathers started the wall, but they could not finish it. Fellas, this is our day. I had a thought, says Nehemiah. I wrapped it in passion. I prayed. And then I went to see the king. Last question. What opportunities has God put before me at this time that other people don't have? Last verse of chapter 1, I was cut bearer to the king. By the way, that's more like a personal secretary. That's why they sent the whole cavalry with him when he went back home. You protected your assets, and the cupbearer was an asset. And Nehemiah knows this, and he says, God has put me in a position that is peculiar to most people, and I will use that position to tell His story. Oh, God, lift our eyes off of classes and schedules and practices and details and decisions on a daily basis and help us to see something bigger and more grand that You've been doing for thousands of years. Because, Father, unless we lose our identity, fall to the ground and die, we cannot become greater than we are. I was in a Bible college just last week, and I was on my way to chapel. And while I was going, someone pulled over to the side, and they offered to pick me up. It was a woman. I almost always say no. But this woman was old enough. I thought, yeah, it's safe. And so I jumped in the car, and we were driving to chapel, and she started in. I'd no sooner lit on the seat when she started, she said, "Man, is this place awesome?" She said, "Man, you know what happened?" She said, "Just a couple years ago, I was working as like a manager and administrator over some stores, and I heard that there was an opening here, and so I applied for it. I called them and applied for it, and they gave me the job. They let me come here." I said, "Well, you must like it. I love it. Do you know what we are doing? We are taking kids and we are sending them out into the world." She said, "Some of them are missionaries and some are pastors and some are youth pastors and Christian teachers." She said, "And the most incredible thing is that a few years from now, they're going to be all over the world and we're going to be able to trace what they're doing out there back to the stuff that we gave them while they were here." Man, is that awesome. Who wouldn't like that? I said, "Well, tell me, what do you teach?" She said, "Oh, I don't teach. I'm a housekeeper." She said, "I clean tables in the cafeteria when the kids are through eating." I remember saying, "You have really found your niche, haven't you?" You bet she has. Do you realize there are people making way more money, doing way more important things, but they matter infinitely less in the scheme of things because they have not paid attention to the story God will tell. Now, this morning when you leave, ask yourself, what is God saying at this time in our world? What has He put in my heart as a passion to do? What is the need to which I will connect it? What opportunities lie before me to serve the present age? My calling to fulfill. Oh, may it all my powers engage to do my master's.
As always, we welcome your feedback on each month's tape. Feel free to give us a call with your comments, or if you prefer, you may fax or email our office. Better yet, check out Grandin Associates on the World Wide Web. Our totally redesigned website now has a complete listing of all of the products and services Grandin Associates has to offer. Our address is www.grandiassociates.com, and it is also printed on the tape insert. Again, our website address is www.grandiassociates.com. As a reminder, our 3-day Basic Business Bootcamp continues to take the industry by storm. For more information, check out our website or give us a call for a free 4-page flyer on the bootcamp that provides all the details. The Service Contractor's Business Tape of the Month is produced and distributed by Grandin Associates. If we can be of service to you, give us a call on our toll-free line, 1-800-432-7963. Until next month, remember, invest your time and invest your money in those things that will reproduce.